What is that? That's a new hoodie.
No.
Overproof, white overproof rum.
Yeah. Ray and nephew.
Ray and nephew.
Ray and nephew.
All right. This episode is brought to you by alcohol.
Ray and nephew.
Ray and nephew, why celebrate Ramadan without your family when you can with Uncle Ray and his nephew?
J. Ray and
White
nephew.
overproof
There you go.
rum. How was your Juno night last night?
It was good. It was good. I enjoyed it. It was, I thought the performances were great.
Yeah.
I thought Anne Marie was awesome, as Anne Marie always is.
Really? At the beginning?
Yeah.
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 That was good.
I as soon as I said to Kel a few times, Scarborough Spots is going to have a field day on Instagram.
Yes.
And
Yes.
sure enough, I wake up and my Instagram feed's filled with Scarborough Spots and all their shout outs to Scarborough. And
Oh yeah, man.
it was a Scarborough
Absolutely.
celebration night.
It was awesome, right? And right at the end. Right at the end of his speech. Yeah, he shouts out Scarborough, man. That was awesome. That was really good. It was interesting. My brother was messaging me and he goes, "Man, this Junos is amazing." And I couldn't tell whether he was joking or not. The performances were great. Like
And
top.
the variety of the performances. You know what I mean?
Oh,
It
of
wasn't just
course.
like it wasn't just like, you know, there were five pop songs and that was it, right? Like
Yeah.
it was great.
It would the Beaches group of the year, fantastic. They were great. Talk was awesome. Oh my goodness, Talk was awesome. And that Indigenous showcase they did. The one where Jeremy, is it Dutcher? Am I pronouncing his name correctly? He was playing the piano. He was awesome. And then what blew it away for me was the Robbie Robertson tribute.
The big performance, yeah.
Ah, that was fantastic. That was really, really good.
I thought it was interesting that they played a song by the band and not one of Robbie Robertson's solo stuff, but you know.
That's his song.
Yeah.
And it gets you a bunch of singers that song, right? Because just the way the song is put together. It was just amazing. But yeah, Scarborough, where we don't make records, we make history. That was the line. That was the line. But the performances were great. It was there was something, I don't know, it felt like a high school event. People running around in the backgrounds. You can see people in the back getting stage set up and sweeping and it was hilarious. I go, yeah, only in Canada do we are you
But I
gonna
thought that
see
was
this?
great. I remember seeing, and it was Double Bill of Nine Inch Nails and Soundgarden,
All right.
and Soundgarden, or sorry, Nine Inch Nails,
Yeah.
their entire set was very similar. Like, as there were panels of light and stuff, and they would
Yeah.
literally people would be coming out and moving the panels around on the stage. I thought that's really just breaking it down. I said that like I thought that was cool. So last night to me was reminiscent of that.
Yeah, it was funny. But who was the host? Could you tell who the host was last night?
Nelly?
Or was it Odaria Williams?
I don't know.
Could you
I thought
tell?
Nelly Furtado was there.
Well, that's who it was. It was the announced guest. But it seems like she was hardly, she kind of was, you know, it was a different type of hosting gig. I thought I heard more from Odaria Williams than I did from Nelly Furtado. You know, so I was like, wait a second. But yes, it was great. It was great to see past guests on. It was what's that group's name that won? Ocon won an award, but it wasn't
Ocon
televised.
won another Juno, which was great. I saw that. I paused it, went, hey.
Julian Taylor, of course, sang, hit some of those high notes. And before This version of the podcast launch, we had Lou Kalla was a guest, and she presented an award. I can't remember which. Oh, it was the album of the year she presented with that CBC dude from I was gonna say Schitt's Creek, but it's not that TV show. But anyways, it was good to see Lou Kalla on stage. And of course, our 100th episode guest, Maestro Fresh Williams. Maestro Fresh West.
Did you just say?
I said Wes. I meant Wes Williams, but then Maestro Fresh got in there. But yes, Wes Williams is his name. Maestro Fresh West.
I know.
Not Maestro Fresh Williams. He had a good speech too.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great speech. He thanked, I think, everybody.
He thanked former guest Classified.
Yes.
He thanked, well, obviously, Cardinal Official.
He thanked future guest.
Socrates?
I was waiting for you to see that. Yes.
For anybody listening to this and you want to go back to the episode with Maestro Fresh West, and you will realize the moment when Kareem asked a question to him, and I swear, because it was in front of a live studio audience, which I was a part of, I swear Meister was about to walk up and get up and leave the interview. He was so aghast by the questions.
Oh, man. I am looking forward to our upcoming guest, Greg.
Yes, very much so.
Now, our guest's name is Ron Hawkins. Lead singer, co-founder, Lowest of the Low, and a few other bands. And so, you know, we put our research team on the case to do a little bit of research. And I don't know about your team, Greg, that you have at home, but the team at my house got confused a little bit between Ron Hawkins of Lowest of the Low and Rockin' Ronnie Hawkins. And I thought that was cute. I don't know whether your team had the same issue.
Actually, my team went off in a completely different direction and had nothing to do with either Ron or Ronnie Hawkins. And by teams, we are talking about our AI assistants.
Yes.
No, actually, I was looking up. I texted you. I was looking up for the opening band back in 2019, I think it was, when I last saw Lowest of the Low. And it was kind of funny because I asked the question two different ways and it gave me two different answers. So I'm not sure. I'm 99.999% confident it was not Billy Bragg that opened up for Lowest of the Low at the Danforth Music Hall. Unless I'm missing something and forgetting it, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't Billy Bragg.
So. Well, listen, let's get to our guests. And before we do, thank everybody for joining us on Welcome to the Music. And go check out all our other episodes at welcometothemusic.com and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Ron Hawkins from Planet Earth and from Lowest of the Low, the Do Good Assassins, the Rusty Nails, and Ron Hawkins.
Awesome. I forgot one more thing. That was awesome. Great, great intro.
he's already blowing the intro. Go ahead.
No, that was on me.
I know you.
Welcome to the
I'm
music.
Sorry, guys.
No, that's on me.
No, it's not you. It's him. It's not you at all. Anyway, all good. Ron, it's a pleasure to have you. It's an honor. I remember back probably, I would guess it's 91. For some reason, I think we were doing something with Jive, Earl Jive, and Beverly Hills out in the West End somewhere. Anyway, went to Kennedy Road, and they were doing the listening of all the new tracks that were coming in.
Right.
And, you know, Martin Streak was there and a few other people in the room. And they put on one of the tracks from the first album. And I just personally remember going, wow, like, just wow. So, you know, I know I've said this to, and Cream's getting sick of me saying it. I know I said this to Moberg. I know I said this to Craig Naughty, but I have to thank you for Shakespeare in My Butt. It is like, to me, it just song after song after song, beautiful, perfect album. But what I really want to know, the question that's coming is, how did you feel when the Yellow album outsold you shortly thereafter?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because we were so flabbergasted. I was going to say that, you know, like when you're in it and you're doing it, nothing makes any sense. Like I didn't really understand why Lowest of the Low took off after our band Popular Front sort of flailed around for a while and didn't make it. You know, like it was not very clear to me, you know, what the difference was, but something sparked, you know. And so, yeah, I think when we were doing it back then, we were just doing it every day, and we were bewildered and bewitched by the fact that we were getting so much traction, and we were just going out and doing what we would do anyway. We would do it if we were being ignored, or we would do it if we were being lauded, you know. So I think when the ladies sort of overtook us, yeah, it wasn't really on our radar to gripe about it, because we felt so so good about it. And we always have Buffalo, which is apparently we were still the biggest indie selling album in Buffalo history. So we'll always have Buffalo.
That's
what counts. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, like I just thank you for that album.
Well, can I ask you this? Like, so because I don't know what it would have been. So you heard a song from that record and it kind of jumped out at you in a way that maybe the other songs weren't jumping out at you or something?
Yeah, they were basically, it was, I don't remember what song it was off the album. I just remember, I don't remember. They were basically going through all the tracks that were either released or sent or whatever for that period of time, for that week. I remember it was, who did War Pigs? Who covered War Pigs? Anyway, it was like really weird, like a weird mix of music that they were all listening to and that, right. You know, basically it was a thumbs up, thumbs down, whether it was going to get on the air or not. And I don't remember the song. I would love to, but I just remember hearing it and just like, you know, myself and my bandmates were like, wow, this is.
But it always gives me, it's always interesting to me, because I can remember for myself when I heard things that it's almost like, okay, that gets its own place on the shelf. You know, like when I first heard Billy Bragg, because it was like, huh, I've never heard anybody completely own their Cockney accent that heavily on album before, and saying the kind of socialist love songy kinds of things that he did. Or when I, you know, came across the Pistols or the Clash, like all of these things, it was sort of like, wow, okay, that isn't all the other stuff I'm hearing, you know, and it just goes in these little, or Costello, you know, Elvis Costello, just like, wow, he can be so mean and so smart at the same time. Like he can use those words to wound so, you know, so sharply. So it's, I'm always fascinated, like, because I know lots of people have said that, like they heard something off Shakespeare, or they heard Shakespeare and sort of stopped and went, what's that? You know, like, because it seemed different to them then. But because we're so in it, I never really know what that thing is. You know, it's just, I just feel like it's glaringly apparent all the things we stole to make that sound, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess that's not the case, but like, that's how rock and roll works, as Elvis Costello would say, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, for me, it was like, it was, and again, I just heard the one tracks, so that we went out and got the album to listen to it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, it was just, again, just song after song after song. And it reminded me of, you know, Love Junk and Bed Bugs, and just like, again, just albums that were so, so amazing and unique and Canadian. And I think we had something really uniquely Canadian, to be redundant, at that time with those albums.
Yeah, for sure.
I was reading an article that I think Dave McPherson had written about. It was written like, I think it was the 25th anniversary or something of Shakespeare. And he talks about, I think he has a conversation with you, and you were talking about writing that album, you wanted to pick a side of politics. And maybe I'm of course paraphrasing there, but you bring up politics and making sure you had sort of a stance. And I'm curious about that. Ron, and why was that important to you to have a side or to have an opinion and to make sure that your music reflected that?
Yeah, I mean, you may be misremembering that a little bit in terms of, like, I feel like, well, just to give you some back story, like when I was 15, 16 years old, I became very political as a kid, and I became a Marxist very quickly and sort of moved very far left and was also at the same time learning to become a musician. But the two things in my mind at the time were kind of separate lanes.
Okay.
And then at some point, and again, probably I could lay this at the feet of the Clash or somebody like that, suddenly the math seemed to make sense where I could do both of those things at the same time. And I could make, you know, Billy Bragg and stuff like that. Like I could take my political opinions and my music and it could make a thing, you know. Yeah. And I've always been maybe even a little bit like embarrassingly or too far to the side of like, I don't want my music just to be some kind of shitty consumer entertainment, you know? Yeah. And I fucking hate the word content. Like, oh my God, I hate the word content. I don't make content, you know, mm-hmm. I make art. In my mind. And so that's where I came from with that. And then the first two bands, Social Insecurity and to a lesser extent Popular Front, were both, you know, pretty capital P political bands, you know, political kind of punk bands and, you know, world music kind of bands and stuff like that. So by the time we hit Lowest of the Low, I guess the thing that had changed was, of course, I was the same political person that I am, and I still saw the world the same way, but I found a way to make those put those politics kind of more in personal stories about people.
Okay.
So in a way, the capital P turned into a smaller, you know, a lowercase p, and I sort of embedded the politics in the poetry of the people, of the songs and the characters and everything. And then over the last two little records, we kind of gone back just because everything is so batshit crazy out there that I couldn't stop myself. And the last two records, Welcome to the Plunder Dome and Agitpop, were both sort of back to, here's what I'm actually saying, you know,
yeah,
writ large, you know. Yeah, so it's been a lovely way to try and put everything that I think I am as a person into the songs, you know.
Yeah, I've asked a lot of artists this during these episodes, you know, about some of their, you know, the earliest hits, and asking them about their relationship to the songs. Do they still enjoy playing them? You know, and how they feel about, you know, the first songs that they wrote as a band. And I read somewhere that your relationship to Shakespeare, My Butt, is it's both a gold medal, you celebrate it, but it's also an albatross, something that sort of weighs you down. I wonder if you can sort of discuss those two different sides.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't think that's just me. I think that's kind of everybody who has some kind of success early. And to, you know, and to, just to put a fine point on it, you know, Shakespeare My Butt in 91, you know, I started with my band Social Insecurity in 83. So I'd already had almost a decade of writing songs and not releasing them, but writing them and playing them live. So it's not really the first things I did, but it was the first thing that got that kind of attention.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody, like every historic musician and every current musician I know who has had any kind of success, seems to deal with the same thing. Like my friend Mick Thomas and Weddings, Parties, and Anything in Australia, they got, you know, their first couple of records, and Roaring Days is a big one, and it's an early album of theirs. And it's sort of like, he's like, you know, you have this great success and it's amazing, but then you kind of spend a lot of the rest of your life having everything compared to it. And what I've learned over the years is you cannot, you know, I no matter what record I make, no matter what, you know, if I fell into a genius well and came out and wrote 12 songs that tore the top of everybody's head off, I still couldn't really put them back in university with no, you know, absolutely no commitments and no, you know, just getting, living their life by the minute and getting drunk and hanging out, and maybe they fell in love at the show or whatever. Like that's what you're competing with, not just two records. You're competing with an entire experience somebody had when they first saw you, and now this new record, you know, has to live up to all that other stuff. And it's impossible because our crowd, you know, though we have lots of young kids coming out and lots of actually kids of original fans, most of our fan base is still the same fan base it was back then. So, you know, now they've had to get a babysitter, and they've had to, you know, there's their mortgage, they're like, can we afford to go to the show? You know, like all that, instead of, you know, let's like get 5 of your friends together and go into the show. So, are they, so I really think it's an ecosystem, right? I really think a record is an ecosystem, and it's a stamp, it's a time stamp, it's all kinds of things. So it is exactly that. Like I'm sensible enough to know, like, I'm a super blessed guy to ever have had that experience in my life, and to still be able to have that experience and have people give a shit that I'm writing songs and want to talk to me on Zoom and stuff like this. Like, that's amazing. And at the same time, I still go, oh God, Shakespeare in my butt. I have to, you know, fuck, I gotta rope-a-dope Shakespeare in my butt again. You know?
Do you have to, with some of your original fans, do you have to like start early your concerts now, seeing that maybe they can't stay up so late anymore?
It doesn't seem to be the case. I've actually heard millennials, like I've heard like, I think it seems like everybody's going, when did it become a thing where the opening band goes on at like midnight? When did that become the rule? Because I know lots of people and young people too. They're like, you know, why can't the show be at 8 o'clock?
Yeah. You know,
and we still have a little time afterwards to hang out and drink and then, you know, get home at a reasonable hour. But
that's true.
That's why my wife and I are always like excited if a show is like at History or Danforth or something. And it's anytime a show we want to go see it at the Horseshoe, you're like, oh, we're in for the long run.
Yeah.
We're in for the long run on this one. Absolutely. So 2023, speaking of two albums, you mentioned that earlier, for Lowest of Low, but 2023 was a busy year for you, releasing both the solo album and an album with the band. How do you balance that and the other projects you're working on?
You know, it's funny. I've been telling people recently that I feel like I'm doing Tai Chi or something. It's like, there's just some kind of a flow, you know, and it's just like, here comes this record. And then I go over here and do this low record. And it's like, everything just seems to be kind of like, if I write it down on a piece of paper, I go, holy shit. Cause I also am a visual artist. Like I do paint. I have an 18-year-old daughter. Yeah. It's like, I've got all this stuff if I wrote it down, I'd be like, oh my God, how am I going to get it done? But it just seems to kind of flow. You know, I'm really in a good place in terms of my, whatever my process might be. It seems to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, knock on wood, like there just seems to be no lack of ideas. Like we're already recording another low record. We released one in October and we're in the middle of recording a new one right now. So the ideas are just flying.
There's lots to say, I'm guessing.
Lots to say. And you know, if I had one life philosophy, it's that just be curious all your life. Like, you know, I'm lucky or unlucky to be saddled with a pretty heavy certainty that this is it, that I don't really believe that in God and I don't really believe there's a heaven or a reincarnation or any of that stuff. So, you know, so for me, these are the days. And when I wake up in the morning, that's what I got. It's now, you know, and I want to just keep learning and, you know, and making and supporting other people and, you know, just doing all that till I can't do it anymore.
Yeah. Ron, let's go to we've got this, this segment called Lost Venues. I'm wondering if we can go there for the moment. And I want to sort of, maybe we can talk about a couple of things, because I read about the impact that the Only Cafe on the Danforth had on you. I read somewhere you went there and it wasn't your typical bar where there were fights breaking out. It was one of those things where, I see some of my people. There's people here that are playing games, there's people that are reading books that I'm interested in as well. And so I want to ask you a little bit about the Only Cafe and your remembrance of how it was. I don't know whether Greg, you're that's by your neighborhood now, Greg.
Literally,
I don't know,
but right down the road here.
Yeah. Don't know whether it's changed much. But I also want to ask you, Ron, about a lost venue. Mm-hmm. A place that maybe you played in, maybe it was with a Lowest of the Low or one of your other bands, or on a solo gig that you fondly, or maybe you don't fondly remember it, but it doesn't exist anymore. And maybe you got a cool story.
Yeah. I mean, hands down, the place I would reference is a place called Larry's Hideaway, which used to be at Carlton and Church. And it's not there. It hasn't been there for, I don't know how many years now, but like it hasn't been there for a long time, long enough that there are trees standing where quite mature trees standing where the bar was. But that was one of the very first places I ever got, one of the very first sort of serious venues that I ever got to play with my band Social Insecurity. So we're talking about 1983, 1984. Wow. And, you know, it was run by gangsters and it was a den of, like, they sold drugs out of that place, they sold sex workers out of that place, and they had music going on. And it was a punk rock place, so, like, all the punk kids were there. And the very first time we went, we thought, like, oh, man, we've made it. We're playing Larry's. And we went up. The dressing rooms were up on the second floor. So, as I say, because they were running prostitution out of there, too, I went up there, and the hallway to the band room is just all these very sort of seedy mattresses leaning against the wall, I guess, waiting for their chance to shine. And we went into the band room, and here's this horrible, horrible little, you know, one naked bulb kind of room. And I go over to the sink, and there's a human turd in the sink.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So that was my original introduction to the big time. And then when we were done that night, we played our show. And when we were done that night, Fred, who ran the bar, took me in the office, and he wanted to pay me with sex workers. He was like, you know, rather than give you money. And so I was 17 at the time, right? And I was telling my daughter, who, when she was 17, I was telling her, well, this is what I was doing when I was 17.
Yeah.
And, you know, horrible, like, just horrible stuff. Like, when you tell anybody who wasn't there and in that scene, like, it sounds like a horrible misuse of your youth. But I remember that stuff very sort of course, now through the mists of time, very romantically, about, you know, it was my first experience with just that kind of weird underbelly of the music scene and punk rock. And, you know, we also, the other thing that would happen was, because that band was very, very avidly political and Marxist, and the promoters didn't really know anything about politics. They just knew that we drew a lot of people, and then they would sometimes book us with these Nazi punk bands that also brought tons of people, because they were very popular, and we would be playing the same show. So you can imagine, there were, like, chair fights and chairs flying, and, you know, somebody got stabbed at one of those shows. It was like, it was just kind of a hellscape. But I think about it now, and I'm assuming that kind of nonsense happens somewhere at some shows. I don't know, hip-hop shows or something, but not anywhere that I play anymore. Like, you know, it's so that's a venue. That's a lost venue.
You know, it's funny, is because I've shared my story from Larry's, and I remember probably the same age, probably the same year, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And I remember being in the change room, and we weren't a punk band, but we were like a new wave, Silver LeMay frills, like, I don't even, the drum machine. I don't even know how we ever got the gig. But I remember being in that change room, and some dude opens the door, walks through in his underwear out of his bedroom, goes into that washroom, walks back, and we're like, we're in some guy's fucking apartment. Like, not even apartment. He's probably just renting that one room, and he's using the shared. But it was like, yeah. So I that's why I feel you when you started telling that story.
Oh, man, though, like there was tons of great new wave bands. I love that scene too. Like that, like our scene, our sort of punk scene, there was like these kind of, I don't know, sort of punky funk bands or something, or like almost like Tulpa, that band was kind of like a jazz punk band. And then all the new wave bands, like, I love that era, like ska bands, you know, just, it was just a great scene.
Oh, it was great. I mean, yeah. Even the metalheads, like, we all just, like, everybody just hung out, like, as musicians. And I don't know how you felt, but I, like, our fans would go, why are you hanging out with them? And their fans go, why are you hanging out with them? And we're all just like, we're just musicians. And we go to each other's sound checks and hang out and see each other's shows. And it was very supportive. I love that time.
My other story from Larry's Hideaway was our biggest dream in that band was, we wanted to open for L'Etranger, which was a, you know, very popular band at the time. And I think it was within 3 months of starting our band, we got to open for L'Etranger. So it was like, oh, I guess we need to get a new dream, right? But we opened for them at Larry's Hideaway. And then, I don't know if you remember this, but they would give you these tickets that you were supposed to sell to your friends and stuff.
Yeah.
And they were a certain amount of money. And because we were a little snotty troublemakers, we were giving them away right outside the bar the night of, right? And L'Etranger's manager, Skinny William Ten, got wind of it, and had our drummer in the basement, was like yelling in his face, like, who the hell do you little punks think you are? And as fate would have it, Skinny was actually the lowest of the lows manager 12 years later. So it's a great come around, you know.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
That's awesome. How big the scene is. The scene is about that big, you know.
And does he remember that story?
Yeah, he remembers that story.
That is hilarious. Oh my goodness. Ron, you've got some really cool instruments around you. Curious if you'd like to play a song.
Sure, I could do that. I'll grab this acoustic guitar that's over here.
Yeah.
Because that would probably make more sense than trying to crank up an amp or something. Let's see. Yeah, Larry's Hideaway. There's another place called The Turning Point. I'm sure you played.
Never did. Never did.
Used to be up on Bloor Street, and it was sort of like the precursor for us to Larry's. We played The Turning Point first. It would give us like a 3-night stretch.
And no, Larry's was literally my first Toronto gig. I grew up in Durham, so Whitby. So Larry's, you know, I think I was 16 driving in, so I've been like 83, and yeah, it was like I thought I made it. And then I was like a deer in the headlights for the rest of the evening.
The first time I played there, I had to have a note from my mom, which was not very punk rock, but
that's hilarious.
I was too young to be in there and, you know, try to surreptitiously hand that to the door person without anybody seeing it.
I remember.
Even the bands, they'd card, eh? That's hilarious.
And you're supposed to go in, play, and then get out. I mean,
so much illegality going on there. I don't know why they were worried about, you know, respecting that law.
16-year-old kid.
Yeah, so this is one off the last record, which is called Welcome to the Plunder Dome.
And liars, Holocaust deniers, all second guesses, Second Amendments, but who'll defend the new defendants? This is brave new world, it's not for the faint of heart, for the lovers of the starving artists, for the worms and the snakes and the rats and varmints, and boys who can't keep their rage in their undergarments. I just have to ask, if you're an anti-fascist, then oh. With open hearts, we're gonna weaponize affection, gonna march in a new direction.
As a musician, you know, yesterday we had the Juno celebration. A bunch of awards were given out this past weekend in Halifax. Do you have hope for where, not, you know, where music is going, but also where the world is going as a musician, as someone that sort of, you know, sings about what's going on in the world? Your thoughts on where things are going and where things are heading?
Well, you know, I seem to be an eternal optimist in terms of, like, I really do believe that people have the capacity collectively to create whatever it is that they want to create. And so I'm sort of frustrated. What frustrates me is what it seems that large chunks of people want to create, you know, this sort of I don't know. It seems very clear to me. Hmm. Like, you know, here's a good example. I will get into arguments with people in a bar or something after a show, and we're in the United States, and I talk to Marines and Republicans and Democrats, whoever, right? And they'll get thrown by the idea of something like they want to talk about how I'm a socialist or something like that. And I say, like, let's just get rid of all of these labels, and I'll just tell you what kind of world I'd like to live in. And you tell me if you think that's crazy, you know, and the leading things, that is like where we take care of each other, where maybe the natural resources of the places we live in are held in kind by everybody who lives there, so everybody benefits from them. How, you know, we can keep the corporation, the sort of corporate entities to a minimum, and maybe billionaires are not a good idea, you know, like, and just make, you know, and it seems like people are quite willing to come on this path with me and agree that all these things would be good things to do. And they either get tripped up by, you know, how do you pay for them in this kind of a system, or, you know, things like that. And I guess, you know, and then sometimes people's religious beliefs or economic beliefs maybe will get in the way, but it, you know, this is not crazy stuff that I'm talking about. You know, it's just people taking care of each other. And I feel like what we've been able to do in our band with our music community is exactly that. We've got each other's backs. And I don't just mean the bands we play with or ourselves. I mean, like, the audience who comes to see us. You know, we feel like it's all just part of one big, you know, cell, one big organism, you know, like we don't, you go, of course, we know that we make the music and they pay to come and hear us play the music, but we're all interested in what everybody's doing. And, you know, a good example was during COVID when I was doing something called Tommy Douglas Tuesdays. Yeah. So every Tuesday during COVID, I played a free show on Facebook. And it was just great to see everybody in the chat, you know, all the people that used to come. There was an outlet for us all to talk to each other and stay connected. And so I'm optimistic about people. I'm not super optimistic about where the world is right now, because I mean, I feel like for my daughter who's 18, you know, climate change, AI seems pretty daunting, you know, with shit that could go down with AI and stuff like that. And the fact that I don't see people, you know, see, people seem to be getting more divided. And people seem to be willing to spout crazier and crazier things in positions of power. You know, I can't believe somebody on the Senate floor or the Congress floor can talk about Jewish space lasers, or, and nobody goes, all right, you know, you're going to have to clear out your desk because clearly,
yeah,
you need some serious help and you shouldn't be a senator, you know. But I mean, that's where we are. So, you know, the other side of it is like I often have say, like, you know, every now and then I'll just kind of go, like, I'm not even sure I'm a musician. Like, I feel like I'm a person who's interested in this, like building a new world, building a community. And music happens to be one of the ways I try to do it. But I'm not really interested in just making songs, you know? I make songs, but I mean, I want them to have some kind of a message, and I want them to be part of some kind of project, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if they're not, I think I would lose interest, you know?
Well, Ron, listen, on behalf of fans, young and old, and new fans and old fans, number one, thank you for the music.
Yes.
Thank you. To you and your bandmates, and you know, bandmates from all of your different bands. And firstly, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. This has been fun.
Well, thanks, guys. Thank you.
Yeah. And before we let you leave, if people want to find out where you're playing, where they can get your music, is there, you know, what website can they go to? Can they go to your personal website to grab all the details?
If they go to ronhawkins.com, then they will see all my stuff and all my painting stuff and all of the low stuff. And if they can't be bothered with Ron Hawkins, but they want to know what the lowest of the low are up to, they can go to lowestofthelow.com, and that's just all lowest of the low stuff there.
Awesome. Our guest has been Ron Hawkins. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.